That night, the news of the arrest flies around the whole city. Many a breast is swelled with resonant indignation. Many a hand is clenched. But there were not a few gloating sneers. Aha, they've put the ruffian away, removed the impudent, yowling yokel, as it was expressed by the slightly cracked anyway lady novelist Kochanowski. Next, Stanoyevsky gives a striking description of the complex work which the authorities had to carry out in order to create the evidence, which should have been there but was not, for a very curious situation had arisen. Judicially speaking, there was nothing to fasten onto, and they had to build a scaffolding for the law to climb up and work. So they worked with dummy quantities, calculating to remove carefully all the dummies only when the emptiness enclosed by the law was filled up by something actual. The case built up against Chernyshevsky was a phantom, but it was the phantom of genuine guilt. And then, from outside, artificially, by a roundabout route, they managed to find a certain solution to the problem which almost coincided with the true one. We have 3 points. C, K, P. A catheter is drawn, CK. To offset Chernyshevsky, the authorities picked out a retired Uhlan cornet, Vladislav Dmitrievich Kostomarov, who the previous August in Moscow had been reduced to the ranks for printing seditious publications. A man with a touch of madness and a pinch of Pechorinism about him, and also a verse maker. He left a scolopendrine trace in literature as the translator of foreign poets. Another catheter is drawn, K.P. The critic Pisarev, in the periodical The Russian Word, writes about these translations, scolding the author for the magnificent Taiera's coruscation like a pharos, from Hugo, praising his simple and heartfelt rendering of some lines by Burns, which came out as, and first of all, let all men honest be, let's pray that man be to each man a brother, first of all, etc. And in connection with Kostomarov's report to his readers that Heine died an unrepentant sinner, the critic roguishly advises the grim denouncer to take a good look at his own public activities. Kostomarov's derangement was evidenced in his florid graphomania, in the senseless, somnambulistic, even though made to order, composition of counterfeit letters studded with French phrases, and finally, in his macabre playfulness. He signed his reports to Putilin, a detective, Feofan Ochenashenka, Theophanus R. Fatherson, or Wenceslav Luty, Wenceslaus the Fiend. And indeed, he was fiendish in his taciturnity, funeste and false, boastful and cringing. Endowed with curious abilities, he could write in a feminine hand, explaining this himself by the fact that he was visited at the full moon by the spirit of Queen Tamara. The plurality of hands he could imitate, in addition to the circumstance, yet one more of Destiny's jokes, that his normal handwriting recalled that of Chernyshevsky, considerably heightened the value of this hypnotic betrayer. For indirect evidence that the appeal proclamation to the serfs of landowners had been written by Chernyshevsky, Kostomarov was given first the task of fabricating a note, allegedly from Chernyshevsky, containing a request to alter one word in the appeal, and secondly, of preparing a letter to Alexei Nikolaevich that would furnish proof of Chernyshevsky's active participation in the revolutionary movement. Both the one and the other were then and there concocted by Kostomarov. The forgery of the handwriting is quite evident. At the beginning, the forger still took pains, but then he seems to have grown bored by the work and to be in a hurry to get it over. To take but the word I, ya, formed in Russian script somewhat like a proofreader's deal. In Chernyshevsky's genuine manuscripts, it ends with an outgoing stroke, which is straight and strong, and even curves a little to the right, while here in the forgery, this stroke curves with a kind of queer jauntiness to the left, toward the head, as if the Ya were saluting. While these preparations went on, Nikolai Gavrilovich was held in the Alexeyevsky Ravelin of the Peter and Paul Fortress, in close proximity to the 22-year-old Pisaryev, who had been imprisoned there 4 days before him. The hypotenuse is drawn, CP, and the fateful triangle CPK is consolidated. At first, life in prison did not oppress Chernyshevsky. The absence of importunate visitors even seemed refreshing. But the hush of the unknown soon began to chafe him. A deep matting swallowed without a trace the steps of the sentries pacing along the corridors. The only sound that came from the outside was a clock's classic striking, which vibrated long in one's ears. It was a life whose portrayal demands from a writer an abundance of dots. It was that unkind Russian isolation from which sprang the Russian dream of a kind multitude. By lifting a corner of the green baize curtain, the sentry could look through the peephole in the door at the prisoner sitting on his green wooden bed or on a green chair, wearing a dressing gown of frieze and a peaked cap. One was permitted to keep one's own headgear as long as it was not a top hat, which does credit to the government's sense of harmony, but creates by the law of negatives a rather tenacious image. As for Pisaryev, he sported a fez. He was allowed a goose quill pen, and one could write on a small green table with a sliding drawer, whose bottom, like Achilles' heel, had remained unpainted. Stranolyubsky. Autumn passed. A small rowan tree grew in the prison yard. Prisoner number 9 was not fond of walking. At the beginning, however, he went out every day, reasoning, a quirk of thought extremely characteristic for him, that during this time the cell was searched. Consequently, a refusal to go out for a walk would cause the administration to suspect he was hiding something there. But when he had become convinced that this was not so, by leaving threads here and there as marks, he sat down to write with a light heart. By winter, he had finished his translation of Schlosser and had begun to translate Gervinus and T.B. Macaulay. He also wrote one or two things of his own. Let us recall the diary, and from one of our much earlier paragraphs, let us pick up the loose ends of some sentences dealing in advance with his writings in the fortress. Or no, let us go, if you please, even further back, to the lacrimatory theme, which began to rotate on the initial pages of our mysteriously revolving story. Before us is Chernyshevsky's famous letter to his wife, dated December 5, 1862, a yellow diamond among the dust of his numerous works. We examine this harsh-looking and ugly but amazingly legible handwriting, with its resolute strokes at the tails of the words, with loopy R's and P's, and the broad, fervent crosses of the hard signs, and our lungs dilate with a pure emotion such as we have not experienced for a long time. Stranolyubsky justly designates this letter as the beginning of Chernyshevsky's brief flowering. All the fire, all the power of will and mind allotted him, everything that was supposed to burst forth at the hour of a national uprising, to burst forth and clutch in its hold, even if only for a short time, the supreme power, to jerk violently the bridle and perhaps to crimson the lip of Russia, the rearing steed, with blood. All this now found a sick outlet in his correspondence. One can say, in fact, that here was the aim and crown of all his life's dialectic, which had long been accumulating in muffled depths, these iron, fury-driven epistles to the commission examining his case, which he included in letters to his wife, the exultant rage of his arguments, and this chain-rattling megalomania. "Men will remember us with gratitude," he wrote to Olga Sokratovna, and he turned out to be right. It was precisely this sound which echoed and spread through all the remaining space of the century, making the hearts of millions of intellectual provincials beat with sincere and noble tenderness. We have already referred to that part of the letter where he talks of his plans for compiling dictionaries. After the words, "as was Aristotle," come the words, "I have begun speaking, however, of my thoughts. They are a secret. You must not tell anyone about what I say to you alone." Here, comments Steklov, on these two lines, a teardrop has fallen, and Chernyshevsky had to repeat the blurred letters. This is not quite right. The teardrop fell, near the fold of the sheet, before the writing of these two lines. Chernyshevsky had to rewrite two words, "secret" and "about," one at the beginning of the first line, the other at the beginning of the second, words which he had started to trace each time on the wet place, and which remained therefore unfinished. 2 days afterwards, getting more and more angry and more believing in his invulnerability, he began to maul his judges. This second letter to his wife can be divided up into points. 1. I told you in connection with the rumors about my possible arrest that I was not mixed up in any affair and that the government would be forced to apologize if it arrested me. 2. I assumed this because I knew they were following me. They boasted that they were doing it very well, and I relied on their boast, for my calculation was that, knowing how I lived and what I did, they would know that their suspicions were groundless. 3. It was a stupid calculation, for I also knew that in our country people are incapable of doing anything properly. 4. Thus, by my arrest, they have compromised the government. 5. What can we do? Apologize? But what if he doesn't accept the apology, but says, "You have compromised the government. It is my duty to explain this to the government." 6. Therefore, we shall postpone the unpleasantness. 7. But the government asks from time to time whether Chernyshevsky is guilty, and finally the government will obtain an answer. 8. It is that answer I am waiting for. The copy of a rather curious letter from Chernyshevsky, added Potapov in pencil. But he is mistaken. No one will have to apologize. A few days after that, he began to write his novel, What to Do. And by January 15th, he had sent the first portion to Pipin. A week later, he sent a second, and Pipin handed both to Nekrasov for the Contemporary, which had again been permitted, beginning with February. At the same time, the Russian Word was also allowed after a similar 8-month suspension. And in the impatient expectation of journalistic profit, the dangerous Fez's neighbor had already dipped his pen. It is gratifying to be able to state that at this juncture, some mysterious force resolved to try and save Chernyshevsky at least from this mess. He was having a particularly hard time. How could one fail to have compassion? On the 28th, because the government, exasperated by his attacks, had refused him permission to see his wife, he began a hunger strike. Hunger strikes were then a novelty in Russia, and the exponent they found was clumsy. The guards noticed that he was wasting, but the food seemed to be getting eaten. When, however, 4 days later, struck by the putrid smell in the cell, the warders searched it, they established that the solid food had been hidden among the books, while the cabbage soup had been poured into cracks. On Sunday, February 3rd, at about 1 p.m., the military doctor attached to the fortress examined the prisoner and found that he was pale, his tongue fairly clear, his pulse a little weak. And on that same day, at that same hour, Nekrasov, on his way home, corner of Lyukhenaya and Basyenaya streets, in a hackney sleigh, lost the pink paper package containing two manuscripts, each threaded through at the corners and entitled What to Do. While remembering with the lucidity of despair the whole of his route, he did not recall the fact that when nearing his house he had laid the package beside him in order to take out his purse, and just then the sleigh had turned, a crunch as it skidded, and What to Do rolled off unnoticed. This was the attempt of the mysterious force, in this case centrifugal, to confiscate the book whose success was destined to have such a disastrous effect upon the fate of its author. but the attempt failed. On the snow near the Mariinsky Hospital, the pink package was picked up by a poor clerk burdened with a large family. Having plodded home, he donned his spectacles and examined his find. He saw that it was the beginning of some kind of literary work, and without a tremor and not burning his sluggish fingers, he put it aside. "Destroy it," begged a hopeless voice. In vain. A notice of its loss was printed in the St. Petersburg Police Gazette. The clerk carried the package to the indicated address, for which he received the promised reward, 50 silver rubles. In the meantime, his jailers had begun to give Nikolai Gavrilovich appetite-stimulating drops. Twice he took them, and then, suffering greatly, he announced that he would take no more, for he was refusing to eat, not from absence of appetite, but from caprice. On the morning of the 6th, owing to lack of experience in discerning the symptoms of suffering, he ended his hunger strike and had breakfast. On the 12th, Potapov informed the commandant that the commission could not permit Chernyshevsky to see his wife until he had completely recovered. The following day, the commandant reported that Chernyshevsky was well and writing at full blast. Olga Sokratovna came with loud complaints about her health, about the pippins, about the shortage of money, and then through her tears began to laugh at the little beard her husband had grown, finally getting even more upset and commencing to embrace him. "That will do, my dear, that will do," he kept saying quite calmly, using the tepid tone he invariably maintained in his relations with her. Actually, he loved her passionately, hopelessly. "Neither I nor anyone else can have any grounds for thinking I shall not be set free," he told her in parting, with particular emphasis. Another month passed. On March 23rd, there was the confrontation with Kostomarov. Vladislav Dmitrievich glowered and obviously got tangled up in his own lies. Chernyshevsky, with a slight smile of disgust, replied abruptly and contemptuously. His superiority was striking. "And to think," exclaimed Steklov, "that at this time he was writing the buoyant What to Do." Alas, to write What to Do in the fortress was not so much surprising as reckless, even for the very reason that the authorities attached it to his case. In general, the history of this novel's appearance is extremely interesting. The censorship permitted it to be published in the Contemporary, reckoning on the fact that a novel which was something in the highest degree anti-artistic would be certain to overthrow Chernyshevsky's authority, that he would simply be laughed at for it. And indeed, what worth, for example, are the light scenes in the novel? Vierochka was supposed to drink half a glass for her wedding, half a glass for her shop, and half a glass for the health of Julie, a redeemed Parisian prostitute who was now the girlfriend of one of the characters. She and Julie started a romp with screams and clamor. They began to wrestle, and both fell on the sofa, and they no longer wanted to get up, but only continued screaming and laughing, and both fell asleep. Sometimes the turn of phrase smacks of folksy barrack lore, and sometimes of Zoschenko. After tea, she went to her room and lay down. So there she is, reading in her comfy bed, but the book sinks away from her eyes, and now Vera Pavlovna is thinking, "Why is it that somehow I feel lately somewhat dull sometimes?" There are also many charming solecisms. Here is a specimen. When one of the characters, a doctor, has pneumonia and calls in a colleague, "For a long time they palpated the sides of one of them." But nobody laughed. Not even the great Russian writers laughed. Even Herzen, who found it vilely written, immediately qualified this with, "On the other hand, there is much that is good and healthy." Still, he could not resist remarking that the novel ends not simply with a phalanstery, but with a phalanstery in a brothel. For, of course, the inevitable happened. The eminently pure Chernyshevsky, who had never been to a brothel, in his artless aspiration to equip communal love with especially beautiful trappings, involuntarily and unconsciously out of the simplicity of his imagination, had worked his way through to those very ideals that had been evolved by tradition and routine in houses of ill repute. His gay evening ball, based on freedom and equality in relations between the sexes, first one and then another couple disappears and returns again, is extremely reminiscent of the concluding dances in Madame Tellier's establishment. And nevertheless, it is impossible to handle this old magazine, March 1863, containing the first installment of the novel, without a certain thrill. Here also is Nekrasov's poem, Green Noise. Endure while you can still endure. And the derisive dressing down of Alexei Tolstoy's romance, Prince Serebryany. Instead of the expected sneers, an atmosphere of general pious worship was created around what to do. It was read the way liturgical books are read. Not a single work by Turgenev or Tolstoy produced such a mighty impression. The inspired Russian reader understood the good that the talentless novelist had vainly tried to express. It would seem that, having realized its miscalculation, the government should have interrupted the serialization of What to Do. It behaved much more cleverly. Chernyshevsky's neighbor had now also done some writing. He had been receiving the Contemporary, and on October 8th he sent the Russian Word an article from the fortress, Thoughts About Russian Novels, at which the Senate informed the Governor-General that this was nothing else but an analysis of Chernyshevsky's novel, with praise for this work and a detailed exposition of the materialistic ideas in it. In order to characterize Pisaryev, it was indicated that he was subject to dementia melancholica, for which he had been treated. In 1859, he had spent 4 months in a lunatic asylum. Just as in his boyhood he had arrayed all his notebooks in rainbow covers, so as a grown man, Pisaryev would suddenly abandon some urgent work in order to painstakingly color woodcuts in books. Or, when going off to the country, would order a red and blue summer suit of sarafan calico from his tailor. This professed utilitarian's mental illness was distinguished by a kind of perverted aestheticism. Once, at a student gathering, he suddenly stood up, gracefully raised his curved arm, as if requesting permission to speak, and in this sculpturesque pose, fell down unconscious. Another time, to the alarm of his hostess and fellow guests, he began to undress, throwing off with gay alacrity his velvet jacket, motley vest, checkered trousers. At this point, they overpowered him. Amusingly enough, there are commentators who call Pisaryev an epicure, referring, for example, to his letters to his mother, unbearable, bilious, teeth-clenching phrases about life being beautiful. Or else, to illustrate his sober realism, they quote his outwardly sensible and clear, but actually completely insane letter from the fortress to an unknown maiden with a proposal of marriage. The woman who agrees to lighten and warm my life will receive from me all the love which was spurned by Raisa when she threw herself at the neck of her handsome eagle. Now, condemned to a 4-year imprisonment for his small part in the general disturbances of the time, which were based in a way on a blind belief in the printed word, especially the secretly printed word, Pisaryev wrote about What to Do, reviewing it bit by bit for the Russian Word as the installments appeared in the Contemporary. Although in the beginning the Senate was puzzled by the novel's being praised for its ideas instead of being ridiculed because of its style, and expressed the fear that the praises might have a deleterious effect on the younger generation, the authorities soon realized how important it was in the present case to obtain by this method a complete picture of Chernyshevsky's perniciousness, which Kostomarov had only outlined in the list of his special devices. The government, says Stranolyubsky, on the one hand permitting Chernyshevsky to produce a novel in the fortress, and on the other permitting Pisaryev, his fellow captive, to produce articles explaining the intentions of this novel, acted with complete awareness, waiting curiously for Chernyshevsky to babble himself out and watching what would come of it. in connection with the abundant discharges of his incubator neighbor. The business went smoothly and promised a great deal. But it was necessary to put pressure on Kostomarov, since one or two definite proofs of guilt were needed, while Chernyshevsky continued to boil and jeer in great detail, branding the commission as clowns and an incoherent quagmire which is completely stupid. Therefore, Kostomarov was taken to Moscow, and there the citizen Yakovlev, his former copyist, a drunkard and a rowdy, gave important testimony. For this he received an overcoat, which he drank away so noisily in Tver that he was put in a straitjacket. While doing his copying, on account of the summer weather in a garden pavilion, he allegedly heard Nikolai Gavrilovich and Vladislav Dmitrievich, as they were strolling arm in arm, a not implausible detail, talking about greetings from well-wishers to the serfs. It is difficult to find one's way in this mixture of truth and promptings. At a second interrogation, in the presence of a replenished Kostomarov, Chernyshevsky said somewhat unfortunately that he had visited him only once and not found him in. Then he added forcefully, "I'll go gray, I'll die, but I will not change my testimony." The testimony of his not being the author of the proclamation is written by him in a trembling hand, trembling with rage rather than fright. However that may have been, the case was coming to an end. There followed the Senate's definition. Very nobly, it found Chernyshevsky's unlawful dealings with Herzen unproved, for Herzen's definition of the Senate, see below at the end of this paragraph. As for the appeal to the serfs of landowners, here the fruit had already ripened on the espaliers of forgery and bribes. The absolute moral conviction of the senators that Chernyshevsky was the author thereof was transformed into judicial proof by the letter to Alexei Nikolaevich, meaning apparently A. N. Pleshcheyev, a peaceful poet dubbed by Dostoevsky an all-round blonde, but for some reason no one insisted too much on Pleshcheyev's part, if any, in the matter. Thus, in Chernyshevsky's person, they condemned a phantasm closely resembling him. An invented guilt was wonderfully rigged up to look like the real one. The sentence was comparatively light, compared with what one is generally able to devise in this line. He was to be exiled for 14 years of penal servitude, and then to live in Siberia forever. The definition went from the savage ignoramuses of the Senate to the gray villains of the State Council, who completely subscribed to it, and then went on to the sovereign, who confirmed it, but reduced the term of penal servitude by half. On May 4, 1864, the sentence was announced to Chernyshevsky, and on the 19th, at 8 o'clock in the morning, on Mitninsky Square, he was executed. It was drizzling, umbrellas undulated, the square was beslushed, and everything was wet. Gendarmes' uniforms, the darkened wood of the scaffold, the smooth black pillar with chains glossy from the rain. Suddenly the prison carriage appeared. From it emerged with extraordinary celerity, as if they had rolled out, Chernyshevsky in an overcoat and two peasant-like executioners. All three walked with swift steps along a line of soldiers to the scaffold. The crowd lurched forward, and the gendarmes pressed back the front ranks. Restrained cries sounded here and there, "Close the umbrellas!" While an official read the sentence, Chernyshevsky, who already knew it, sulkily looked around him. He fingered his beard, adjusted his spectacles, and spat several times. When the reader stumbled and barely got out socialistic ideas, Chernyshevsky smiled, and then, recognizing someone in the crowd, nodded, coughed, shifted his stance. From beneath the overcoat, his black trousers concertinaed over his rubbers. People standing near could see on his chest an oblong plaque with an inscription in white, "State Crimen," the last syllable had not gone in. At the conclusion of the reading, the executioners lowered him to his knees. The elder one, with a backhander, knocked the cap off his long, combed back, light auburn hair. The face, tapering chinward, its large forehead shining, was now bent down, and with a resounding crack, they managed to break an insufficiently incised sword over him. Then they took his hands, which seemed unusually white and weak, and put them in black iron secured to the pillar. He had to stand that way for a quarter of an hour. The rain increased. The younger executioner picked up Chernyshevsky's cap and jammed it on his inclined head. And slowly, with difficulty, the chains got in his way, Chernyshevsky straightened it. Behind a fence to the left, one could see the scaffolding of a house under construction. Workmen climbed onto the fence from the other side. One could hear the scrape of their boots. They climbed up, hung there, and abused the criminal from afar. The rain fell. The elder executioner consulted his silver watch. Chernyshevsky kept turning his wrists slightly without looking up. Suddenly, out of the better-off part of the crowd, bouquets began to fly. The gendarmes, jumping, tried to intercept them in midair. Roses exploded in the air. Fleetingly, one was able to see a rare combination, a policeman wreathed. Bobbed-haired ladies in black burnouses threw racemes of lilac. Meanwhile, Chernyshevsky was hastily released from his chains and his dead body borne away. A slip of the pen. Alas, he was alive. He was even cheerful. Students ran beside the carriage with cries of "Farewell, Chernyshevsky! Au revoir!" He thrust his head out of the window, laughed, and shook his finger at the most zealous runners. "Alas, alive," we exclaimed. For how could one not prefer the death penalty, the convulsions of the hanged man in his hideous cocoon, to that funeral which 25 insipid years later fell to Chernyshevsky's lot? The pore of oblivion began slowly to gather in his living image as soon as he had been removed to Siberia. Oh, yes. No doubt students for years sang the song, "Let us drink to him who wrote What to Do." But it was to the past they drank, to past glamour and scandal, to a great shade. But who would drink to a tremulous little old man with a tick, making clumsy paper boats for Yakut children somewhere in those fabulous backwoods? We affirm that his book drew out and gathered within itself all the heat of his personality, a heat which is not to be found in its helplessly rational structures, but which is concealed, as it were, between the words, as only bread is hot, and it was inevitably doomed to be dispersed with time, as only bread knows how to go stale and hard. Today, it seems, only Marxists are still capable of being interested by the ghostly ethics contained in this dead little book. To follow easily and freely the categorical imperative of the general good, here is the rational egoism which researchers have found in What to Do. Let us recall, for comic relief, Kautsky's conjecture that the idea of egoism is connected with the development of commodity production, and Plekhanov's conclusion that Chernyshevsky was nevertheless an idealist, since it comes out in his book that the masses must catch up with the intelligentsia out of calculation, and calculation is an opinion. But the matter is simpler than that. The idea that calculation is the foundation of every action or heroic accomplishment leads to absurdity. In itself, calculation can be heroic. Anything which comes into the focus of human thinking is spiritualized. Thus, the calculation of the materialists was ennobled. Thus, for those in the know, matter turns into an incorporeal play of mysterious forces. Chernyshevsky's ethical structures are in their own way an attempt to construct the same old perpetual motion machine, where matter moves other matter. We would very much like this to revolve. Egoism, altruism, egoism, altruism. But the wheel stops from friction. What to do? Live, read, think. What to do? Work at one's own development in order to achieve the aim of life, which is happiness. what to do. But Chernyshevsky's own fate changed the businesslike question to an ironic exclamation. Chernyshevsky would have been transferred to a private domicile much sooner if it had not been for the affair of the Karakozovites. Adherents of Karakozov, who attempted to assassinate Alexander II in 1866. It was made clear at their trial that they had wanted to give Chernyshevsky the opportunity of escaping from Siberia and heading a revolutionary movement, or at least publishing a political review in Geneva. And, checking the dates, the judges found, in What to Do, a forecast of the date of the attempt on the Tsar's life. The protagonist, Rakhmietov, on his way abroad, said, among other things, that 3 years later he would return to Russia because it seemed, not then but 3 years later, a highly significant repetition typical of our author, he would be needed in Russia. Meanwhile, the last part of the novel was signed on April 4, 1863, and exactly 3 years later to the day, the attempt took place. Thus, even figures, Chernyshevsky's goldfish, let him down. Rakhmietov is forgotten today, but in those years he created a whole school of life. With what piety its readers imbibed the sporty revolutionary element in the novel. Rakhmietov, who adopted a boxer's diet, followed also a dialectical regime. Therefore, if fruit was served, he absolutely ate apples and absolutely did not eat apricots, since the poor did not. Oranges he ate in St. Petersburg, but did not eat in the provinces, because, you see, in St. Petersburg the common people eat them, while in the provinces they do not. Where did that young, round little face suddenly flit from, with its large, childishly prominent forehead and cheeks like two cups? Who is this girl, resembling a hospital nurse, wearing a black dress, with a white turned-on collar and a little watch on a cord? It is Sofia Perovsky, who was to hang for the assassination of the Tsar in 1881. Coming to Sevastopol in 1872, she toured the surrounding villages on foot in order to become acquainted with the life of the peasants. She was in her period of Rakhmietovism, sleeping on straw, living on milk and gruels. And returning to our initial position, we repeat, Sofia Perovsky's instantaneous fate is 100 times more to be envied than the fading glory of a reformer. For, as copies of the contemporary with the novel, passing from hand to hand, became more and more tattered, so did Chernyshevsky's enchantments fade, and the esteem for him, which had long since turned into a sentimental convention, was no longer able to make hearts glow when he died in 1889. The funeral passed quietly. There were few comments in the newspapers. At the requiem held for him in St. Petersburg, the workmen in town clothes, whom the dead man's friends had brought for the sake of atmosphere, were taken by a group of students for plain clothesmen and insulted, which restored a certain equilibrium. Was it not the fathers of these workmen who had abused the kneeling Chernyshevsky from over the fence? On the day following that mock execution, at dusk, with shackles on my feet and a head full of thoughts, Chernyshevsky left St. Petersburg forever. He traveled in a tarantass, and since to read books on the way was permitted only beyond Irkutsk, he was extremely bored for the first month and a half of the journey. On July 23rd, they brought him at last to the mines of the Nyerchin Mountain district at Kadaya, 10 miles from China, 4,600 from St. Petersburg. He was not made to work much. He lived in a badly caulked cottage and suffered from rheumatism. 2 years passed. Suddenly a miracle happened. Olga Sokratovna prepared to join him in Siberia. During most of his imprisonment in the fortress, she, it is said, had been coursing about in the provinces and caring so little about her husband's fate that her relatives even wondered whether she was not deranged. On the eve of the public disgrace, she had sped back to St. Petersburg, and on the morning of the 20th had sped off again. We would never have believed her capable of making the trip to Kadaya if we had not known her ability to move easily and hectically from one place to another. How he awaited her! Starting at the beginning of summer in 1866, together with 7-year-old Misha and a Dr. Pavlinov, Dr. Peacock, we're again entering the sphere of beautiful names, she got as far as Irkutsk, where she was held up for 2 months. There they stayed in a hotel with the enchantingly idiotic name, possibly distorted by biographers, but most probably selected with particular care by sly fate, of Hôtel de Amour et Co. Dr. Pavlinov was not permitted to go any further. He was replaced by a captain in the gendarmes, Chmelevsky, a perfected edition of the dashing Pavlovsk's hero, passionate, drunken, and brazen. They arrived on August 23rd. In order to celebrate the meeting of man and wife, one of the exiled Poles, a former cook of Count di Cavour, the Italian statesman of whom Chernyshevsky had once written so much and so caustically, baked one of those pastries on which his late master had been wont to stuff himself. But the meeting was not a success. It is amazing how everything bitter and heroic which life manufactured for Chernyshevsky was invariably accompanied by a flavoring of vile farce. Chmelevsky hovered about and would not leave Olga Sokratovna alone. In her gypsy eyes there lurked something hunted but also enticing, against her will perhaps. In return for her favors, he is even alleged to have offered to arrange her husband's escape, but the latter resolutely refused. In short, the constant presence of this shameless man made things so difficult, and what plans we had made, that Chernyshevsky himself persuaded his wife to set out on the return journey, and this she did on August 27th, having stayed thus after a 3-month journey only 4 days. 4 days, reader, with the husband whom she was now leaving for 17 odd years. Nekrasov dedicated peasant children to her. It is a pity he did not dedicate to her his Russian women. During the last days of September, Chernyshevsky was transferred to Alexandrovsky Zavod, a settlement 20 miles from Kadaya. He spent the winter there in prison, together with some Karakozovites and rebellious Poles. The dungeon was equipped with a Mongolian specialty: stakes, posts dug vertically into the ground and surrounding the prison in a solid ring. In June of the following year, having completed his probationary term, Chernyshevsky was released on parole and took a room in the house of a sexton, a man who looked very much like him, gray, purblind eyes, a sparse beard, long, tangled hair. Always a little drunk, always sighing, he would sorrowfully answer the questions of the curious with, "The dear fellow keeps writing and writing." But Chernyshevsky stayed there no more than 2 months. His name was taken in vain at political trials. The half-witted artisan Razanov testified that the revolutionaries wanted to catch and cage a bird with royal blood in order to ransom Chernyshevsky. Count Shuvalov sent the Irkutsk governor-general a telegram: "The aim of the émigrés is to free Chernyshevsky. Stop. Please take all possible measures in regard to him." Meanwhile, the exile Krasovsky, who had been transferred at the same time as he, had fled and perished in the Taiga after having been robbed, so that there was every reason to jail dangerous Chernyshevsky once again and to deprive him for a month of the right to correspondence. Suffering intolerably from drafts, he never removed either his fur-lined dressing gown or his lambskin shapka. He moved about like a leaf blown by the wind, with a nervous, stumbling gait, and his shrill voice could be heard now here and now there. His trick of logical reasoning was intensified, in the manner of his father-in-law's namesake, as Stanoyevsky so whimsically puts it. He lived in the office, a spacious room divided by a partition. Along the entire wall in the larger part there ran a low sleeping shelf in the nature of a platform. There, as if on a stage, or the way in zoos they exhibit a melancholy beast of prey among its native rocks, stood a bed and a table which were essentially the natural furnishings of his whole life. He used to get up after midday, would drink tea all day, and lie reading the whole time. He would sit down to do some real writing only at midnight, since during the day his immediate neighbors, some nationalist Poles who were completely indifferent to him, would indulge in fiddling and torture him with their unlubricated music. By profession, they were wheelwrights. To the other exiles, he used to read on winter evenings. They noticed once that although he was calmly and smoothly reading a tangled tale with lots of scientific digressions, he was looking at a blank notebook, a gruesome symbol. It was then that he wrote a new novel. Still full of the success of What to Do, he expected much from it. Most of all, he expected the money, which, printed abroad, the novel was supposed one way or another to bring in for his family. The prologue is extremely autobiographical. When referring to it once, we spoke of its peculiar attempt to rehabilitate Olga Sokratovna. It conceals a similar attempt, in Stranulyubsky's opinion, to rehabilitate the author's own person. For underlining, on the one hand, Volgin's influence, which reaches the point where high dignitaries sought his favors through his wife, because they supposed he had connections with London, that is, with Herzen, of whom the newly fledged liberals were mortally afraid, the author, on the other hand, insists obstinately on Volgin's suspiciousness, timidity, and inactivity. To wait and wait as long as possible. To wait as quietly as possible. One gets the impression that the stubborn Chernyshevsky wants to have the last word in the quarrel, putting firmly on record what he had repeatedly said to his judges. I must be considered on the basis of my actions. And there were no actions, and could not have been any. Concerning the light scenes in the prologue, we'd better keep silent. Through their morbidly circumstantial eroticism, one can make out such a throbbing tenderness for his wife that the least quotation from them might appear to be exaggerated derision. Instead, let us listen to this pure sound in his letters to her during those years. My dearest darling, I thank you for being the light of my life. I would be, even here, one of the happiest men in the world if it did not occur to me that this fate, which is very much to my personal advantage, is too hard in its effects on your life, my dear friend. Will you forgive me the grief to which I have subjected you? Chernyshevsky's hopes for literary profits were not realized. The émigrés not only misused his name, but also pirated his works. And entirely fatal for him were the attempts made to free him, attempts which were in themselves courageous, but which seem senseless to us, who can see from the hilltop of time the disparity between the image of a fettered giant and the real Chernyshevsky, whom these efforts by his would-be saviors only enraged. These gentlemen, he said later, didn't even know that I can't ride a horse. This inner contradiction resulted in nonsense, a particular shade of nonsense already long known to us. It is said that Ippolit Mishkin, disguised as a gendarme officer, went to Vilyuysk, where he demanded of the district police chief that the prisoner be handed over to him, but spoiled the whole business by putting his shoulder knot on the left side instead of the right. Before this, namely in 1871, there was Lopatin's attempt, in which everything was absurd. The way he suddenly abandoned the Russian translation of Das Kapital that he was making in London, in order to get for Marx, who had learned to read Russian, den großen russischen Gelehrten. His journey to Irkutsk in the guise of a member of the Geographical Society, with the Siberian residents taking him for a government inspector incognito. His arrest, following a tip-off from Switzerland, his flight and capture, and his letter to the Governor-General of Eastern Siberia, in which he told him all about his project with inexplicable frankness. All this only worsened Chernyshevsky's situation. Legally, his settlement was supposed to begin on August 10, 1870, But only on December 2nd was he moved to another place, to a place which turned out to be far worse than penal servitude, to Vilyuysk. Forsaken by God in a dead end of Asia, says Stranolyubsky, in the depths of the Yakutsk region far to the northeast, Vilyuysk was nothing but a hamlet standing on a huge pile of sand heaped up by the river and surrounded by a boundless bog overgrown by taiga scrub. The inhabitants, 500 people, were Cossacks, half-wild Yakuts, and a small number of low middle-class citizens, whom Steklov describes very picturesquely. The local society consisted of a pair of officials, a pair of clerics, and a pair of merchants, as if he were talking about the Ark. There, Chernyshevsky was lodged in the best house, and the best house turned out to be the jail. The door of his damp cell was lined with black oilcloth. The two windows, which anyway were right up against the palisade, were barred up. In the absence of any other exiles, he found himself in complete solitude. Despair, helplessness, the consciousness of having been deceived, a dizzy feeling of injustice, the ugly shortcomings of Arctic life, all this almost drove him out of his mind. On the morning of July 10, 1872, he suddenly began to break the door lock with a pair of tongs, shaking all over and mumbling and crying out, "Has the sovereign or a minister come that the police sergeant dares to lock the door at night?" By winter, he had calmed down a bit, but from time to time there were certain reports. And here we are granted one of those rare correlations that constitute the researcher's pride. Once, in 1853, his father had written him, regarding his A Tentative Lexicon of the Hypatian Chronicle, "You would do better to write some tale or other. Tales are still in fashion in good society." Many years afterwards, Chernyshevsky informs his wife that he has thought up in his prison and wants to set down in writing an ingenious little tale wherein he will portray her in the form of two girls. "It will be quite a good little tale," repeating his father's rhythm. "If only you knew how much I have laughed to myself when depicting the various noisy frolics of the younger one, how much I cried with tenderness when depicting the pathetic meditations of the elder." At night, Chernyshevsky, reported his jailers, sometimes sings, sometimes dances, and sometimes weeps and sobs. The mail went out of Yakutsk once a month. The January number of a St. Petersburg magazine was received only in May. He tried to cure the illness he had developed, goiter, with the aid of a textbook. The exhausting catarrh of the stomach that he had known as a student now returned with new peculiarities. "I am nauseated by the subject of peasants and peasant ownership of the land," he wrote to his son, who had thought to interest him by sending him some books on economics. The food was repulsive. He ate almost nothing but cooked cereals, straight from the pot with a silver tablespoon, of which almost a quarter was worn away on the pot's earthenware sides during the 20 years that he himself was wearing away. On warm summer days, he would stand for hours with his trousers rolled up in a shallow stream, which could hardly have been beneficial, or with his head wrapped in a towel against the mosquitoes, which made him look like a Russian peasant woman, he would stroll along forest paths with his plaited mushroom basket, never plunging into the denser wildwood. He would forget his cigarette case under a larch, which he was some time in learning to distinguish from a pine. The flowers which he gathered, whose names he did not know, he wrapped in cigarette paper and sent to his son Misha, who acquired that way a small herbarium of the Vilyuysk flora. Thus did Princess Volkonsky, in Nekrasov's poem about the Decembrists' wives, bequeath her grandchildren a collection of butterflies, plants of cheetah. Once an eagle appeared in his yard. "It had come to peck at his liver," remarks Stranolyubsky, "but did not recognize Prometheus in him." The pleasure which he had experienced in his youth from the orderly disposition of the St. Petersburg waters now received a late echo. From nothing to do, he dug out canals and almost flooded one of the Villuisque residents' favorite roads. He quenched his thirst for spreading culture by teaching manners to Yakuts. But just as before, the native would remove his cap at a distance of 20 paces and in that position would meekly freeze. The practicality and good sense he used to advocate now dwindled to his advising the water carrier to substitute a regular yoke of wood for the crook made of hair which cut his palms. But the Yakut did not change his routine. In the little town where all they did was play cards and have passionate discussions about the price of Chinese cotton, his yearning for activity in public affairs led him to the Old Believers, about whose plight Chernyshevsky wrote an extraordinarily long and detailed memoir, including even Villuisque gossip, and coolly sent it off addressed to the Tsar with the friendly suggestion he pardon them because they esteem him as a saint. He wrote a lot, but burned almost everything. He informed his relatives that the results of his learned work would undoubtedly be accepted sympathetically. This work was ashes and a mirage. Out of the whole heap of writings which he produced in Siberia, besides the prologue, only 2 or 3 stories and a cycle of unfinished novellas have been preserved. He also wrote poems. In texture, they are no different from those versificatory tasks which he had once been given in the seminary, when he had reset a psalm of David in the following manner. Upon me lay one duty only, to mind my father's flock of sheep, and hymns I early started singing for to extol the Lord withal. In 1875, to Pipin, and again in 1888, to Lavrov, he sends an ancient Persian poem, a ghastly thing. In one of the strophes, the pronoun there is repeated 7 times. Their country is barren, their bodies are fleshless, and through their torn garments their ribs one can tell. Their faces are broad and their features are flattened. Upon their flat features the soul does not dwell. While in the monstrous chains of the genitive case, of howls of the ache of their craving for blood, now, at the parting with literature under a very low sun, there is evidence of the author's familiar leaning toward congruity, toward links. To Pipin, he writes heart-rending letters expressing his stubborn desire to thwart the administration and occupy himself with literature. This thing, the Academy of Azure Mountains, signed Denzel Elliott, purporting to be from the English, is of high literary merit. I am patient, but I hope no one intends to prevent me from working for my family. I am famous in Russian literature for the carelessness of my style. When I want to, I can also write in all sorts of good styles. Weep ye, O for Lilybaeum, we with you together weep. Weep ye, O for Agrigentum, reinforcements we await. What is this hymn to the Maid of the Skies? An episode from the prose story of Empedocles' grandson. And what is the story of Empedocles' grandson? One of the innumerable stories in the Academy of Azure Mountains. The Duchess of Cantorshire has set off with a company of fashionable friends on a yacht through the Suez Canal to the East Indies in order to visit her tiny kingdom at the foot of the Azure Mountains near Golconda. There they do what intelligent and good people of fashion do. They tell stories. Stories that will follow in the next packages from Denzel Elliott to the editor of The Messenger of Europe, Stasiulevich, who did not print any of this. One feels dizzy. The letters swim and fade in one's eyes. And here we again pick up the theme of Chernyshevsky's spectacles. He asked his relatives to send him new ones. But in spite of his efforts to explain it particularly graphically, he nonetheless made a mess of it, and 6 months later he received from them number 4.5 instead of 5 or 5.25. He gave an outlet to his passion for instruction by writing to Sasha about the mathematician Fermat, to Misha about the struggle between popes and emperors, and to his wife about medicine, Karlsbad, and Italy. It ended the way it was bound to end. The authorities requested him to stop writing learned letters. This so offended and shook him that for over 6 months he did not write any letters at all. The authorities never saw the day when they would get from him those humble petitions which, for instance, Dostoevsky used to dispatch from Semipalatinsk to the strong of this world. "There is no news from Papa," wrote Olga Sokratovna to her son in 1879. "I wonder if he, my dear one, is still alive." And she can be forgiven much for this intonation. Yet one more jackanapes with a name ending in ski suddenly pops up as an extra. On March 15, 1881, your unknown pupil Vitievsky, as he recommends himself, but according to police information a tippling doctor at the Stavropol District Hospital, sends him a wire to Vilyuysk, protesting with completely superfluous heat against an anonymous opinion that Chernyshevsky was responsible for the assassination of the Tsar. "Your works are filled with peace and love. You never desired this," that is, the assassination. Whether because of these artless words or because of something else, the government softened, and in the middle of June it showed its jail tenant a bit of thoughtful kindness. It had the walls of his domicile papered in gris pale with a border, and the ceiling covered with calico, which in toto cost the exchequer 40 rubles and 88 kopecks. That is, somewhat more than Yakovlev's overcoat and Musa's coffee. And already the following year, the haggling over Chernyshevsky's ghost was concluded after negotiations between the volunteer security guards, the secret police, and the Executive Committee of the Underground People's Freedom concerning the preservation of law and order during Alexander III's coronation, with the decision that if the latter went off smoothly, Chernyshevsky would be freed. Thus, he was bartered in exchange for Tsars, and vice versa, a process that subsequently found its material expression when the Soviet authorities substituted in Saratov his statue for that of Alexander II. A year later, in May, a petition was submitted in his son's names, he of course knew nothing of this, in the most florid and tear-jerking style imaginable. The Minister of Justice, Nabokov, made the appropriate report, and His Majesty deigned to permit the transfer of Chernyshevsky to Astrakhan. At the end of February 1883, overburdened time was already having difficulty in dragging his destiny, the gendarmes, without a word of the resolution, suddenly took him to Irkutsk. No matter. Leaving Vilyuysk was in itself a happy event, and more than once during the summer voyage up the long Lena, revealing such kinship with the Volga in its meanders, the old man broke into a dance, chanting dactylic hexameters. But in September the voyage ended, and with it the sensation of freedom. On the very first night, Irkutsk appeared as the same kind of casemate in the deepest of provincial backwoods. In the morning he was visited by the chief of the gendarmerie, Keller. Nikolai Gavrilovich sat leaning his elbow on the table and did not respond at once. "The Emperor has pardoned you," said Keller, and repeated it even louder, seeing that the other was apparently half asleep or beclouded. "Me?" said the old man suddenly, then stood up, placed his hands on the herald's shoulders, and shaking his head, burst into tears. In the evening, feeling as if convalescent after a long illness but still weak, with a delicious mist permeating his being, he had tea at the Kellers, talking incessantly and telling the latter's children more or less Persian fairy tales about asses, roses, robbers, as one of his hearers recalled. 5 days later he was taken to Krasnoyarsk, from there to Orenburg, and in the late autumn, at between 6 and 7 in the evening, he drove with post-horses through Saratov. There, in the yard of an inn by the gendarmerie, in the mobile darkness, A wretched little lamp swayed so much in the wind that one simply could not distinguish properly Olga Sokratovna's changeable, young, old, young face, wrapped in a woolen kerchief. She had rushed headlong to this unhoped-for meeting. And that same night, Chernyshevsky, who could tell his thoughts, was dispatched further. With great mastery and with the utmost vividness of exposition, it might almost be taken for compassion, Stranolyubsky describes his installation in his Astrakhan residence. No one met him with open arms. He was invited by no one. And very soon he understood that all the grandiose plans which had been his only support in exile must now melt away in an inanely lucid and quite imperturbable stillness. To his Siberian illnesses, Astrakhan added yellow fever. He frequently caught cold. He suffered acute palpitations of the heart. He smoked heavily and untidily. But worst of all, he was extremely nervous. He had an odd way of jumping up in the middle of a conversation, an abrupt movement stemming, as it were, from the day of his arrest when he had dashed into his study, forestalling the funeste Rakeyev. On the street he could be mistaken for a little old artisan, stoop-shouldered, wearing a cheap summer suit and a crumpled cap. "But tell me, but don't you think, but—" Casual busybodies used to bother him with absurd questions. The actor Siroboyarsky kept on asking him, "Shall I marry or no?" There were two or three last little denunciations which fizzed like damp fireworks. The company he kept consisted of some local Armenians, grocers and haberdashers. Educated people were surprised by the fact that somehow he did not take much interest in public affairs. "Well, what do you want?" he would reply cheerlessly. "What can I make of it all? Why, I haven't even once attended a trial by jury, not once been to a meeting of the Zemstvo." Hair smoothly parted, with uncovered ears too big for her, and with a bird's nest just below the crown of her head, here she is again with us. She has brought candy and kittens from Saratov. There is on her long lips that same mocking half-smile. The martyred line of her brows is still sharper, and the sleeves of her dress are now puffed out above the shoulders. She is already past 50, 1833 to 1918, but her character is still the same, neurotically naughty. Her hysterical fits culminate sometimes into convulsions. During these last 6 years of his life, poor old unwanted Nikolai Gavrilovich translates with machine-like steadiness volume after volume of Georg Weber's Universal History for the publisher Soldatenkov, and at the same time, moved by his ancient, irrepressible need to air his opinions, he tries gradually to smuggle through Weber some of his own ideas. He signs his translation Andreev, and in his review of the first volume, in the Examiner, February 1884, a critic remarks that this is a kind of pseudonym, since in Russia there are as many Andreevs as there are Ivanovs and Petrovs. This is followed by stinging allusions to the heaviness of the style, and by a small reprimand. There was no need for Mr. Andreev to dilate in his foreword on the merits and demerits of Weber, who has long been known to the Russian reader. His textbook came out as early as the 50s, and simultaneously three volumes of his Course of Universal History in the translation of E. and V. Korsch. He would be well advised not to ignore the works of his predecessors. E. Korsch, a lover of arch-Russian terminology instead of that accepted by German philosophers, was by now an 80-year-old man, an assistant of Soldatenkov's, and in this capacity he proofread the Astrakhan translator, introducing corrections which enraged Chernyshevsky, who in letters to the publisher set about mauling Yevgeny Fyodorovich according to his old system, at first demanding furiously that the proofreading be given to somebody else, who understands better that there is not another man in Russia who knows the Russian literary language as well as I do. And then, when he had got his own way, employing another device, "Can I really be interested in such trifles? However, if Korsch wants to continue to read the proofs, ask him not to make corrections. They are indeed ridiculous." With no less bitter pleasure, he also mauled Zakharin, who, out of the goodness of his heart, had spoken to Soldatyenkov regarding a monthly payment of 200 rubles to Chernyshevsky in view of Olga Sokratovna's extravagance. "You were fooled by the effrontery of a man whose mind has been befuddled by drunkenness," wrote Chernyshevsky to Soldatyenkov. And setting in motion the whole apparatus of his logic, rusty, creaky, but still as wriggly as ever, he at first justified his ire by the fact that he was being taken for a thief who wished to acquire capital, and then explained that his anger was actually only a sham for Olga Sokratovna's sake. "Thanks to the fact that she learned of her extravagance from my letter to you, and I didn't give in to her when she asked me to soften my expression, there were no convulsions." At this point, the end of 1888, another brief review happened along, by now on Weber's 10th volume. The terrible state of his mind, wounded pride, an old man's crotchetiness, and the last hopeless attempts to shout down the silence, a feat even more difficult than Lear's attempt to shout down the storm, all this must be remembered when you read through his spectacles the review on the inside of the pale pink cover of The Messenger of Europe. Unfortunately, it appears from the foreword that the Russian translator has remained true to his simple duties as a translator only in the first 6 volumes, but beginning with the 7th volume, he has laid upon himself a new duty, to clean up Weber. It is hardly possible to be grateful to him for the kind of translation where the author is refurbished, and such an authoritative author at that as Weber. "It would seem," remarks Stranolyubsky here, somewhat mixing his metaphors, "that with this careless kick, destiny had given the last suitable touch to the chain of retribution it had forged for him. But that is not so. There remains for our inspection one more most terrible, most complete, ultimate punishment."